I was given a book this past week by someone who picked it up at the garage sale, and it's a book entitled Women's Liberation, Blueprint for the Future. And as I mentioned last week, I've been kind of dry on getting messages, kind of last minute before church on Sundays. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something in here that I could work a message up from. And as I got into it and started reading it, I was surprised with a lot of things that I found in this and how it affected me. I was especially surprised at how this book affected me, but I'll be talking about that more as we go on. But I certainly found a message in this book. Matter of fact, I found a whole series and maybe two series in this book. So this will be the introduction to a series. The book was subtitled, as I just read, A Blueprint for the Future. You know, yet at the same time, I think there are people today who believe that the Women's Lib movement is something of the past. You don't hear the same terms as we used to in the 1960s and 70s. You don't hear it as out front in some ways as we used to. And as a result, I think some people think that there's no longer a blueprint for the future. It's of the past. Well, don't you believe it? Have you taken a look at the White House lately? Take a look at Congress after the last election and what's happened. Look at most political action groups today, who is making them up. And look at what's happening in the business and corporate world today. And if you take a good look, you'll indeed see. And if you have ears to hear, you'll indeed hear that the Women's Lib movement is certainly not dead. Let me assure you, the women's liberation, or what's sometimes called feminism, is well and alive and flourishing on planet Earth, especially here in the good old USA. With that in mind, I'd like you to turn this morning for the passage that I'm going to use probably for the text for this series of messages throughout. Isaiah chapter 3. Beginning with Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 11. Verse 11 says, "Woe to the wicked! It will go badly with him, for what he deserves will be done to him." Now, obviously, and especially within the context, it could be just as easily applied, and really is applied in the plural, not necessarily in the singular. Verse 11 again, "Woe to the wicked! It will go badly with him or them, for what he deserves will be done to him." First, I want you to know that the wicked are being addressed in this passage. And by the way, so that there's no misunderstanding, Isaiah is not addressing the wicked Canaanites, Philistines, or any other pagan tribe of people or nation of people. No, you know exactly, I'm sure, who he's addressing. The wicked, ungodly, disobedient Israelites. That's who Isaiah's mission was to. Secondly, note that he says that it will go badly for them, and that the wicked will get what they deserve. Now, we say, well, that's great when we think about all the other wicked. You know, when we think about maybe the Edomites or the Canaanites, well, we're glad to know it's going to go badly for them and that they're going to get what they deserve. And indeed, that's the case with them as well. And for the remnant of Christian Israel, they can rejoice in that. That day is coming. But no, we're not talking about the Edomites or the Canaanites. It's talking about that it's going to go badly for Israel, wicked Israel. When she's wicked, it makes no difference that she's Israel. If she's wicked, it will go badly for her, and she will indeed get what she deserves. Well, just what is it that is going badly for wicked Israel, and what is it that she deserves? Look at verse 12. "Oh, my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. O my people, those who guide you, lead you astray, and confuse the direction of your paths." What is it? Their oppressors are women and children. I've shared this before in another message. Isn't it interesting, in light of this passage, that within the Clinton administration are found more women than any previous administration, and it's the youngest cabinet on record? Women and children ruling over us. Verse 12, last part. "O my people, those who guide you will lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths." It's then a given. When women and children rule over us, it results in a curse. In this message, the first of what I suspect will be a short series, I plan to address the women's liberation movement in light of the book that was given to me this past week, or in other words, in light of what women libbers say themselves, in contrast to the light of the Scriptures. The title of the book, again, is Women's Liberation, A Blueprint for the Future. Well, the title of this message is Women's Liberation, A Blueprint for a Curse. Let me begin with an overview of this book by reading the front and back covers of this book to you. Women's Liberation, Blueprint for the Future, A Comprehensive Study of the Theories, Actions, and Goals in the Fight for Women's Rights. First time in book form, published and unpublished articles by outstanding advocates of an ever-growing social revolution, including Kate Millett, Susan Brown Miller, Marta Lamb, and others, compiled by Sookie Stambler. On the back, it says, Women's Liberation, What's It All About? Why have thousands of women of every age and walk of life banded together to overthrow the established order? Why now, at this particular moment in history? By the way, this was compiled in 1970. In a collection guaranteed to rock the stolid, that may be a printing error there. I guess it happens to them too. Is it not stolid is a word? Stolid foundation? Oh, rats. I guess it just happens to me. Just happens in my book. Okay. In a collection guaranteed to rock the stolid foundation of establishment complacency, the new feminists boldly present their visions, their theories, and their action in their own words, including women on men, women on women, women on sex, women in arts and letters, plus additional thought-provoking articles from contributors to the Ladies' Home Journal, the New York Times, the Village Voice, Liberation News Service, the Atlantic Monthly, Mademoiselle, Now, and other publications of equal stature. Blueprint for the Future, an honest, outspoken statement of where the women's liberation movement is at and why. Also, Sookie Stambler, not sure that's how you pronounce her name, but that's the best I can come up with, Sookie Stambler, who compiled these writings, also wrote this in the introduction. Quote, the writings in this book are all the work of women active in the movement. Within these articles, one can find many of the basic concepts and essential ideas that have inspired women to join the movement or that have made thousands of women sympathetic to our cause. End of quote. By that statement, one can see that this book was compiled as a recruitment tool for the women's liberation movement. And by reading it, and I haven't got all the way through it yet, I just got it Thursday, but by reading it, by what part I have read thus far, I can see very clearly how it would make women sympathetic to their cause. Now, there's no doubt that some of the articles contained therein are representative of the more radical factions of feminism. Boy, I'm going to read, I think we'll probably get into it next week. I'm going to read almost one of the complete articles. It's unbelievable, nearly the whole thing. Of one of those that are without doubt more to the, I'm going to say to the right, I guess they're on the far left. One of the more radical women advocates of feminism. There's no question that some of those articles are written from that faction. However, women who want to align themselves with this movement need to know that it is these more radical factions which govern and set the goals and the direction of the women's liberation movement. Now, I'm convinced that most women don't know that. My wife didn't know that. Not by the way that she's anyway involved with the women's liberation movement, but we were talking about it, and she looked at the book, and she it was a surprise to her to see some of the things that were being propounded. And I think that's the case with the average woman. I'm convinced that most women, that the average woman thinks it's just about equal pay for equal work. I really think that's as far that it goes in the minds of most women. And unless a woman is involved in the inner machinations or one who's attending the national meetings where they're deciding the agenda, women wouldn't know any different for the most part. Well, if you are a woman and that's all you think that this movement is about, you're in for a surprise. If you think that the women's liberation movement was just about women's rights, then listen to the following. Susan Brown Miller, in one of the articles compiled in this book, makes the unmistakable distinction between women's rights and women's liberation. Listen to what she said. Quote, radical feminist groups, creators of the concept of women's liberation as opposed to women's rights, exist in all major cities. End of quote. There's a major difference, in other words. When you're talking about the feminist or the women's liberation movement, this woman says it's in opposition to women's rights. And yet that's what most women would probably think women's liberation is all about. Let me also read a couple of other especially revealing statements. This one, again, from Sookie Stambler. She says this, quote, 200 years ago, if women dared to assemble together at all, it was to cook and to sew and to do jobs allotted to them by men. Now women get together to challenge the traditional roles forced upon them, end of quote. Now let's see if we can interpret what's really being said there. The last sentence says this again. Now women get together to challenge the traditional roles forced upon them, end of quote. Well, what do they mean by traditional roles? Or how should we understand what they mean by traditional roles? Well, what traditional roles are the women trying to liberate themselves from? Let me just give you four quick ones here. One, men's authoritarian position in the home and society. Two, this goes hand in hand, women's subordinate position in the home and the family. Number three, traditional morality on sex and abortion. And number four, traditional child care. Now you tell me, where do those traditional roles or values originate from? They originate from God, don't they? They originate from God's Word, the Bible. So let it be clearly understood that when women libers speak of challenging traditional roles, they are in reality challenging traditional biblical roles. Now, you won't find them address religion or the Bible or God very much in their writings. They're very careful about how they go around it, because they know that if they are just blatant with their real agenda in that fashion, that it's going to be harder to recruit some women, that they have to get them in the movement before they can really let them know what they're dealing with. But in reality, it is a fact that they are challenging traditional biblical roles ordained and set in order by their Creator, Yahweh, the God of the universe. Even one of their own writers, quoted in this book, admits to this in an offhanded way. Kate Millett wrote this, quote, patriarchal, that is, male or father rule. Patriarchy has God on its side. End of quote. They admit it themselves. Let it also be understood that the agenda of these feminists is not just to challenge biblical roles, but to overthrow biblical roles. I didn't say that well. Not to challenge biblical roles, but to overthrow biblical roles. The back cover quote, I guess I have it photocopied here. One of the quotes from the back cover, Stambler wrote this, "We have thousands of women of every age and walk of life banded together to overthrow the established order." End of quote. And again, we know what established order they intend to overthrow. In other words, the bottom line to the feminist movement in reality is just an attempt to, by individual and collective women, to liberate themselves. No question about that, right? I mean, that goes without saying. It's a liberation movement. But in reality, it's just an attempt by individual and collective women to liberate themselves from God. That's what the movement, bottom line, is all about. They are just women opposed to and in rebellion to God, His rules, His standards, His principles, His law, and His word. That's what it is. And any woman already involved who has inclination towards the women's liberation movement needs to know this. Because in rebellion to simply means to be held accountable to. They think they're liberating themselves from God. They're putting themselves under the bondage of God, the curse of His judgment. You see, any attempt to liberate oneself, whether it be man or woman, from God and His Word simply makes one more answerable to God and His Word. And it will be His Word that we are judged by. John 12 and verse 48, where it says, He who rejects me, Yeshua is speaking, He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who judges him or her in this case. The word I speak is what will judge her or him in the last day. End of quote. Now, if a society allows women to rule, or put another way, if society allows, condones, or promotes women's rebellion to God, because that's what it is, if a society allows women to rule, they're just allowing or promoting women's rebellion to God, then that society can expect to suffer the curses of God. Let me prove it to you from the past. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 42. Jeremiah 42 and verses 1 through 6 to begin with. Now, this is following. Setting here is at this point that we're going to be reading in Jeremiah 42. It's following the capture of Jerusalem and some of the surrounding region by King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians. It's shortly after that. Beginning then in Jeremiah 42, starting with verse 1, it says, Then all the commanders of the forces, Johanan the son of Kareah, Jezaniah the son of Hoshea, and all the people, both small and great, approached and said to Jeremiah the prophet. Now in this case, these commanders of the forces are those of the remnant of Judah who were left behind. We're not here talking about the Babylonian army or their commanders. We're talking about Judah's remnants of the commanders that were left back with Jeremiah. It says they approached, small and great approached and said to Jeremiah the prophet, Please let our petition come before you and pray for us to Yahweh your God, that is, for all this remnant, because we are left but a few out of many, as your own eyes now see us. That Yahweh your God may tell us the way in which we should walk and the thing that we should do. Then Jeremiah the prophet said to them, I have heard you. Behold, I am going to pray to Yahweh your God in accordance with your words, and it will come about that the whole message which Yahweh will answer you, I will tell you. I will not keep back a word from you. Then they listened to their response to that. Verse 5, Then they said to Jeremiah, May Yahweh be a true and faithful witness against us if we do not act in accordance with the whole message with which Yahweh your God will send you to us. Whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, we will listen to the voice of Yahweh our God, to whom we are sending you, in order that it may go well with us when we listen to the voice of Yahweh our God. Boy, sounds like we've got some righteous people that have finally learned their lesson. I mean, they've seen what happened. They saw the devastation, the famine, the siege of Jerusalem, and the majority of the people being taken away, and probably the women being raped, and children and men being killed. It appears that we've got finally righteous, repentant people here that are ready to say, God, whatever you want, we're ready to do it. And so Jeremiah delivers the message. But now, listen to part of this remnant's response to what Jeremiah shared with them from God. Go over to Jeremiah, turn to Jeremiah chapter 44. Jeremiah chapter 44, and beginning with verse 15. Verse 15, Then all the men who were aware that their wives were burning sacrifices to other gods, along with all the women who were standing by as a large assembly, including all the people who were living in Pathros in the land of Egypt, responded to Jeremiah, saying, As for the message that you have spoken to us in the name of Yahweh, we are not going to listen to you. Now let's stop there. Can't you just see it? Here are these big macho men standing before Jeremiah, and then they look around behind them and see their wives. Now, they've previously just said, whatever Yahweh says to you, we're going to follow. Now they're here, Jeremiah's given them God's message. And they're standing there again before Jeremiah, or still standing before Jeremiah. They're ready to respond again to Jeremiah and what's been told them that they need to do. And they look up, and then they look behind them, and they see their women, their wives, standing behind them. And their wives give them that look. Now, any of you husbands know what I'm talking about when I talk about that look. Because you've all experienced it, I'm sure, at least once, and probably several times. But their wives give them that look. Now, the wives give them that look, and then they answer Jeremiah. Not with what they know is right, but rather how they know their wives want them to respond. Again, it says, "Then all the men who were aware that their wives were burning sacrifices to other gods." See, the men weren't looking at themselves. They thought, oh my goodness, you know, it's my wife that's doing this. I've got to take her into consideration in this situation. And so forth and so on. And as a result, they then respond, starting with verse 16, going on through verse 17. "As for the message that you have spoken to us in the name of Yahweh, we are not going to listen to you. But rather, we will certainly carry out every word that has proceeded from our mouths by burning sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out libations to her, just as we ourselves, our forefathers, our kings, and our princes did in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem, for then we had plenty of food, and we were well off and saw no more misfortune. But since we stopped burning sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out libations to her, we have lacked everything and have met our end by the sword and by famine." Now let me ask you, what were those men then guilty of? You might say, well, they were probably browbeat. Let me guarantee you, they were guilty right then of a much severe, greater sin, travesty before God than that. They were guilty of treason. Let me ask you this, how should treason be punished? It's a capital crime, isn't it? Turn to Deuteronomy 13. Keep your finger there in Jeremiah. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 13. God's law is indeed clear on this. Deuteronomy 13, you might want to read the first three verses as well, but beginning with verse 4 and then jumping to verse 6. Verse 4 says, "You shall follow Yahweh your God and fear Him, and you shall keep His commandments, listen to His voice, serve Him, and cling to Him." Verse 6. Well, let's read verse 5 with it. "But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against Yahweh your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which Yahweh your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you." And that's what verses 1 through 3 is all about. The dreamer of dreams, or the false prophet, who is trying to seduce people from the worship of Yahweh. And you say, that's right. Any false prophet who prophesies in the name of Yahweh should be put to death. Or who prophesies to lead one away from Yahweh should be put to death. But I'll guarantee you, it goes much deeper than that. Verse 6. 6 through 11, we read, "If your brother," not only the false prophet, "but if your brother, your mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul, entice you secretly, saying, 'Let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end,' you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him," or her, by the way, "to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from Yahweh your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such a wicked thing among you." All of a sudden, this women's lib movement, who is the women who... the wives and mothers and sisters who are trying to get others to leave their God, to leave the way of their God, is put in a different light, isn't it? We're talking about not just something that you say, well, you know, we have to put up with those people. No, we're talking about something that's a capital crime in this country, if we ever get back to God's laws and the enforcement of them. And that's what these men were obviously guilty of as well, because they allowed their wives to take them away, not to just serve any other god, no, but the Queen of Heaven. Now back to Jeremiah 44. And then next, after they speak, after the men have spoken for their women, the women themselves, the women livers of that day, speak for themselves. Verse 19. In verse 19 it says, "And said the women, when we were burning sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and were pouring out libations to her, was it without our husbands that we made for her sacrificial cakes in her image and poured out libations to her?" See, the men were actually involved with it the whole time, but they, just like old Adam did, Adam blamed it on Eve at first, and the men here did the same thing. They looked around and saw their wives who had been doing the sacrificing, is what it says. But the women this time pipe up and said, "Wait a minute, the men have been involved in it with us the whole time anyway." Now, note here in this passage that they speak of the Queen of Heaven. You know, there is absolutely, absolutely nothing new under the sun. I've got an article, I don't know where it's from, it's just somebody clipped it out and didn't put the newspaper it came out of on it, or the date, I don't even know when I got it. But here's an article called "Solstice Celebration Slated for Sunday," and here's part of what we find in it. Quote, "On the winter solstice at 4 p.m. Sunday, cakes for the Queen of Heaven will be introduced during a seminar on feminist theology led by Sylvia A. Faulkner." Now, a little bit later, "Cakes for the Queen is a program of 10 sessions for women to explore and reclaim female religious history and its meaning for their lives." End of quote. Now, not only is the Queen of Heaven mentioned in the Bible, but so is offering cakes to her, as we found in that passage also in Jeremiah 7 and verses 18 and 19. "The children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead dough to make cakes for the Queen of Heaven. And they pour out libations to other gods in order to spite me." And I do like the response that God then gives to it. Verse 19, he says, "Do they spite me, declares Yahweh? Is it not themselves they spite to their own shame?" God isn't spited by it. He laughs at it, because he knows it's nothing more than anything but to laugh at, because in the end they're going to be punished for it. It certainly doesn't spite him. They spite themselves. But today's feminists have even taken it to a deeper level of apostasy, at least in my eyes. Feminist Edwina Sandy has created a nude female Christ being crucified, which she calls Christa, which her and her fellow crony female are feminists. They don't even really deserve the name female, I think, anymore, at least as God intended it to be used. But she and her fellow crony feminists or women livers can stand beneath and worship. They can't relate to the male Christ, the male Messiah. So they've built their own nude Christa being crucified on a cross. It's no different. It's just a modern manifestation of worshiping the Queen of Heaven, as they would put it. Well, I suggest that we do with this Queen of Heaven worship what our ancestors are accused of doing in this next article I'll quote from. The name of the article is "Memoirs of a Goddess," from the Alberta Report, April 28, 1986. I guess it's no different in Canada than it is here in the good old United States, and probably no different in this stage of the game throughout the rest of the world. Again, the title of this is "The Memoirs of the Goddess." Again, Alberta Report, April 28, 1986. Beginning at one point, it says, quote, "Artist and self-taught archaeologist Merlin Stone in When God Was a Woman goes one better. Miss Stone," probably should be Ms. Stone, "points to an even earlier period when the world worshipped one god in female form, a single goddess who was Queen of Heaven, omnipotent and creatoress of the universe." A little bit later, "due to the puritanical influence of the Jews." Now, she means Israelites. She's, of course, been taken in like the rest of the world to think that the Jews today are Israel when they're not. But so she's talking about Israelites. "Due to the puritanical influence of the Israelites, writes Miss Stone, "a profound prejudice against female religion has been bequeathed to human history via," she says, "Judaism," she means Hebrewism, via Hebrewism, Christianity, and Islam. And later she says, it's written, quote, what terminated the era of the goddess, she says, was the arrival of the Indo-European or Aryan peoples of the north who worshipped male gods over hundreds of years and over hundreds of years perverted goddess worship. By giving the goddess a male identity or a male consort, sometimes her son and lover. But the chief enemies of goddess worship were the Israelites. And then she goes so far as to state this. The likelihood is, says Miss Stone, that one of the Israelite tribes, the Levites, were in fact not Semitic, but Aryan, and imposed their male god on the other tribes. Now, in fact, they were Semitic, and in fact, they were Aryan, as were all the tribes. But she herself recognizes that one of the key tribes, the priesthood tribe, people who were Israelites, were Aryans. Well, they're all brothers. If the Levites are Aryans, then so are the rest. And then it goes on also, under the sway of the male Yahweh, says Miss Stone, the Israelites ruthlessly exterminated all trace of goddess worship in the name of moral purity. Hallelujah! Shouldn't we be doing the same today? If they were blamed for having done it then, and it's resurrected itself, then certainly us as the progeny or the predecessors of those same Israelite moral men should do the same today. I look forward to the day we do. Now back to the narrative of Jeremiah 44. Well, what's the result of how these women livers and their brow-beaten husbands responded? Well, they're simply cursed. I want to read verses 20 through 27. Then Jeremiah said to all the people as a result of how they responded, to the men and the women, even to all the people who were giving him such an answer, saying, as for the smoking sacrifices that you burned in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, you and your forefathers, your kings and your princes, and the people of the land, did not Yahweh remember them, and did not all this come to his mind? So Yahweh was no longer able to endure it because of the evil of your deeds, because of the abominations which you have committed. Thus your land has become a ruin, an object of horror and a curse, without an inhabitant as it is this day. Because you have burned sacrifices and have sinned against Yahweh, and not obeyed the voice of Yahweh, or walked in His law, His statutes, or His testimonies. Therefore, this calamity has befallen you as it has this day. I would to God that some of these women inclined toward feminism, who are inclined toward the worship of the Queen of Heaven, would read the rest of the account. Because what happened to their predecessors will certainly someday happen to them. They may get all excited about the Queen of the Heaven that some of these other ladies are sharing with them, that they may even say was even found in the Bible. But you know full well they're not reading them the rest of the account. Going on, verse 24, then Jeremiah said to all the people, including all the women, hear the word of Yahweh, all Judah, who are in the land of Egypt. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, as follows, as for you and your wives, you have spoken with your mouths and fulfilled it with your hands, saying, we will certainly perform our vows that we have vowed to burn sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pour out libations to her. Go ahead and confirm your vows and certainly perform your vows. Nevertheless, hear the word of Yahweh, all Judah, who are living in the land of Egypt. Behold, I have sworn by my great name, says Yahweh, never shall my name be invoked again by the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, saying, as the Lord Yahweh lives. Behold, I am watching over them for harm and not for good. And all the men of Judah who are in the land of Egypt will meet their end by the sword and by famine until they are completely gone. Well, the same. You see, they were just cursed. And that's what the women's liberation movement really is. It's not a blueprint for the future. Well, it may be, but it's only a blueprint for a future curse, if it's not already taking place already. The same, of course, is happening all over again. We as a nation, we as a people, are being cursed because of the same thing happening in this generation as well. And once again, we haven't learned the lesson of history that's happened before. Now, let me also mention, regarding this book, a reoccurring term throughout nearly every article in the book that I've read thus far. As a matter of fact, it's a reoccurring term in feminism, period. Mention it to any woman's liver, and she will immediately relate to it. But the question is, does she really understand what it means? I'm referring to the term consciousness raising. In many instances, their small home or town meetings that they have are even called conscious raising groups or sessions. Consciousness raising groups or sessions. Here's what Sookie Stambler had to say about consciousness raising. Collectively, collectively, women begin to see that what they had once been convinced were personal problems are actually political problems. As they undergo consciousness raising, women quickly learn that their problems are not isolated instances, but cultural patterns that restrict and limit them as they try to fulfill themselves as persons. Consciousness raising, unlike psychotherapy, is not meant to benefit one woman alone. It is the very process from which feminist ideologies are born. End of quote. But in reality, that's their definition of consciousness raising. But in reality, what is consciousness raising? That is the, quote, the very process from which feminist ideologies are born, end quote. Well, rather than being consciousness-raising sessions, they are conscience-searing sessions. Rather than being consciousness-raising sessions, I don't want you to miss this, they are conscience-searing sessions. Note how perfectly the Women's Lib movement fits into what is described by the Apostle Paul, and I know they aren't going to like it when I raise the Apostle Paul, I use the Apostle Paul to determine anything. But in this case, they've probably never even thought that this applied to them. Because until I put this message together, I never would have applied this to them. But turn to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 1 through 3. It's these verses that we usually apply to the Catholic Church and some who would apply it to Judaism. But notice how perfectly it fits the women's liberation movement. 1 Timothy chapter 4 verses 1 through 3. But the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith. And it's interesting, this book, how many women had been involved in some sort of Christianity. Now, regretfully, it was probably Judeo or Judaized Christianity, and they got fed up with it because it didn't have very many answers. But many of the women in the feminist movement have been pulled out of at least a semblance of some kind of Christendom. Again, verse 1, but the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. Now, you take a deep look at the feminist movement, and you'll see how entrenched it is in such things as witchcraft. Going on, verse 2, by means of hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. Men, and men, by the way, is in italics, I think it's generally anyone, who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who receive and know the truth. So it identifies them with two identifying marks. Those who forbid or are advocates against marriage, and those who abstain from foods. Isn't it interesting that within the feminist movement you will also find that they're death on marriage? That they, matter of fact, there's at least one group that has a quota on how many married women can even be in it, and it's a small minority. And how they are against, part of their designs, part of their agenda is to get rid of, to abolish marriage altogether. And then on top of that, you'll also find that it's in many cases a big preponderance of those involved in vegetarianism and who are proponents against the killing of animals are also those in the feminist movement. And all of a sudden we've got the feminists fitting this as well. And I think this scripture was meant to apply to not just one group. You know, we just want to pour it on the old poor Catholics for so long. And I've talked about how this also fits Judaism. It's interesting to see how much Judaism has been involved in Catholicism, and as we're going to see, how much Judaism is involved in the feminist movement. And so it's talking about maybe a much wider spectrum than we've looked at it in the past. How perfectly it all fits. And here it talks about not consciousness raising in these last times when many are falling away from the faith, but consciences which have been seared. Their consciousness raising, quote unquote, sessions, as you read about them in this book, are actually nothing but gripe sessions which intensify as more and more women join in and speak. And man, the enemy, I mean, he is their enemy. Man, the enemy becomes bigger and bigger, or smaller and smaller, depending on which perspective you're viewing it from, as these gripe sessions go on, and just build and intensify and build on each other and what each other is saying. And so they want to call it consciousness raising. You know, all of a sudden a woman is starting, she's never heard some of this before, she's sitting in one of these living room meetings, and all of a sudden she's saying, yeah, I've never thought about it that way. That's exactly what my husband does. What's happening? Her conscience is being seared instead. You also see how in the last quote, consciousness raising, quote unquote, was intertwined with, quote, fulfilling themselves as persons, end of quote. That was a part of the description. It's interesting how every ungodly and anti-Christ movement, self is glorified. Self-realization and self-fulfillment is promoted. In actuality, as it is examined, it becomes quite apparent that feminism is just one of the many manifestations of humanism. Isn't that what humanism is all about? Self-realization, self-fulfillment, where self is glorified? Well, as you dig into it, it becomes very, very apparent that feminism is just one of the many manifestations of humanism. Feminism, and the end result is pure, unadulterated feminism is, as it is also true with humanism, by the way, is the deifying of self. That's where it's all about. And there are some feminists who make no apologies about it. In an article called "In Goddess Worship, Is Goddess Worship Finally Going to Put Men in Their Place?" by Sonia L. Nazario, they have no problems testifying, admitting that they're into deifying themselves. Now, from the sounds of the title, though, you would think that the article is going to be more about Queen of Heaven worship or something of that kind. Not hardly. These women have taken it a step further. The title of this article is, again, "Is Goddess Worship Finally Going to Put Men in Their Place?" subtitled, "Spiritual Movement Reveres Mother Earth and Power of the Female Energies." Gives you a hint of where we're going. Here's some of what's written. Miss Barrett, who lives in Los Angeles, is a goddess worshiper, one of the growing number of revisionists who believe it's high time to give credit where credit is due. "It was a woman who modeled Earth," argues Miss Barrett, "and it is men and their male gods who messed it up," end of quote. Also, goddess worshipers believe that to recreate a harmonious world, traits they consider male, dominance, aggressiveness, competitiveness, must give way to female energies, intuition, nurturing, and compassion. Women should be revered, they say, because they bear offspring and are thus linked to nature's cycles. "This isn't just God in drag," insists Susan Gilton Emmer, an artist and goddess worshiper of Reseda, California. And then also later, Judith Piquet, a Los Angeles actress and masseuse, prefers a more private mystery dance when she prays. She demonstrates standing beside two altars in her bedroom. Miss Piquet closes her eyes and sensuously slices the air with her hands. She begins to breathe heavily. A look of ecstasy comes over her face, and as her Rubenesque figure quivers, the dance ends abruptly. Quote within a quote, "I am trying to dance out the separate aspects of the goddess in me," end of quote, within a quote, she exclaims. And then in another similar ritual it says, quote, afterward the women gazed at themselves in handheld mirrors, I am goddess, each intoned, end of quote. Now none of this should surprise anyone. And I've got some other articles that show the same thing. But none of it should surprise anyone who is studying the women's liberation movement. Because when one does, it becomes quite evident that feminism is just an extension of humanism, which is just an extension of Judaism, as I've proven in past messages of the past. And it's also interesting to note in that light how many Jewesses, show up in key positions in the feminist movement. People like Betty Friedan, Ruth Hershberger, Margaret Sanger, Gloria Steinem, etc., etc., etc. But this shouldn't surprise anyone either, because anyone who is studying Judaism knows that rather than being a patriarchal society, Judaism is a matriarchal society. Now see, that's other lady wanted to blame it on the Jews. Well, she couldn't blame it on the Jews of today. That's why I say she had to be talking about the Israelites. Because the Israelites have always proclaimed a patriarchal society. But Judaism, on the other hand, modern day Judaism, which has no tie to the Bible, which does not follow the Old Testament, which has no lineage link with the Israelites, is a matriarchal society. The Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, for example, under the heading Gentile, states this. According to Jewish law, in other words, the Talmud, according to Jewish law, everyone whose mother is a non-Jewess is considered a non-Jew regardless of whether the father is Jewish. In other words, their descent is governed by the mother's side, not by the father's side. James Yaffe, in his book, The American Jews, written in 1968, made these statements. On page 288, quote, it was the mother who ran things in the household. She not only did the cooking, the cleaning, and the punishing, but had charge of the accounts, dealt with the tradesmen, kept the money. End of that quote. On page 289, he stated, quote, it was still the mother who dominated the family, the father who remained a shadowy but awesome figure. End of quote. And, quote, I have talked with dozens of suburban teenagers and have met only a few who didn't say that it was their mother who made the decisions in the family who really ran the home. And, of course, he's talking about Jews, and Jews only here. Quote within a quote, mothers are aggressive people, end of quote, one girl said. Quote, not fathers. They're too busy listening to the mothers, end of quote, within a quote, end of that quote. And then on page 290 he wrote, of, quote, the domination of women in much of Jewish life, end of quote. You see, it's no wonder. It's no surprise that the feminist movement was begun and is still today primarily dominated by Jewish women. Because it's of Jewish origin, and Judaism and the Jewish life is a matriarchal society. No wonder. It's as it is. And that it eventuates in self-worship. Because feminism, as I said, is just an extension of humanism, and humanism is just an extension of Judaism, and it all eventuates in self-worship. Quotes after quotes that I've shared with you in the past shows that their Messiah, they're not looking for the most part, and occasionally you'll find somebody, some groups who are looking for an individual Messiah, but for the most part, the Jewish religion teaches that the people themselves are their Messiah. / their God. And again, I've got the quotes to back it up. It's in the book that's just come out. Now, back to the previous point. Feminism and nearly all isms promote self-realization and self-fulfillment and self-deification. Whereas, in contrast, Christianity does just the opposite. Where, by the way, true fulfillment is found. Turn to Philippians 2 and verses 3 through 9. There's one passage that certainly shows us the exact opposite. Philippians 2, starting with verse 3, it says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in the Christ Yeshua, who although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, But emptying himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name. Verse 5 says, have this attitude in yourselves which was also in the Christ Yeshua. And obviously if we do the same, we can expect the same results. Rather than curses, we can expect blessings. We can expect to be exalted. We can expect to find true fulfillment when doing just the opposite. And now women, I'm speaking to all of us, but women especially, to the women of the feminist movement. If you want fulfillment, you've got to do just the opposite of what the feminists are declaring. They're trying to promote themselves, find themselves, do all of this when instead they should be finding others and serving others, especially their God. Galatians 5:1, Paul here wrote, it was for freedom that the Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Now, isn't bondage, oppression, and slavery what the women libbers are all complaining about? Paul says, don't be caught in it again. And isn't freedom what they are all always promoting? So maybe with that, the statement of Galatians 5:1, maybe Paul has redeemed himself in the eyes of the women libbers. But of course, the feminists don't understand real freedom in its proper context, do they? Here is the balance of verse 1, Galatians 5 and verse 13. It says, for you were called to freedom, brethren. Brethren there, as we know from Galatians 3, includes both men and women. For you were called to freedom, men. You were called to freedom, women. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. But through love serve one another. The exact opposite of what the feminist movement stands for. They don't understand love, and they don't understand freedom. And then under God's chain of authority, and keep in mind, when there is no chain of authority, you end up with anarchy. But under God's chain of authority, women need to also understand and heed Genesis 2, verses 18 through 22. I'm going to just turn there and read this because we're about out of time. Genesis 2, beginning with verse 18, it says, then Yahweh, and they always want to blame poor Paul. Paul usually was just reiterating something from Moses. Verse 18, it says, then Yahweh God said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. And out of the ground Yahweh God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever man called a living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to the cattle and so forth and so on. And then it ends by saying there was not a helper suitable for him. So Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And Yahweh God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from man and brought her to the man. There's no question why woman was created. Paul does elaborate on it. Of course, he's blamed for it, for having done so, in 1 Corinthians 11 and verses 8 and 9, where he said, for man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for woman's sake, but woman for man's sake. End of quote. Within the chain of authority, that's how a woman will find, as God created her to be, will find the only fulfillment available for her. Her fulfillment is in fulfilling God's purpose for her life. Well, I'm out of time. Let's let this serve as the introduction for this series of messages entitled Women's Liberation, a Blueprint for a Curse. As we continue, we'll find that indeed everything that the women's liberation movement stands for is in contradiction to God and His Word. And as such, those who involve themselves in it should expect nothing but curses, disappointments, and heartaches. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.